So crisis of confidence, according to a former mayor, that's what it looked like right outside the Toledo water intake. I think Frank recognizes this individual. It's his boss from the National Wildlife Federation.
Nice.
Jeff, will you raise your hand, please? That is the most famous hand model in the Great Lakes region, and one of the most well-circulated photos. More toxic than was known years ago. Those are some of the some of the scenes from Toledo when we went through the water crisis. Just to kind of put it in people's mind what the crisis was like. This is Jeff Martin, a senior chemist at the water plant. That's our former mayor, Mike Collins, who died of a heart attack a few months later. Craig might want to weigh in on this. This has to do with the water treatment plant, that the 74-year-old water treatment plant, the city of Toledo, had failed to modernize and was kicking the proverbial can down the road. That became one of the dynamics. The water quality of the lake obviously was the real issue, but this certainly was one that we shared some responsibility for in Toledo for not keeping up with the necessary improvements. That's a quote which kind of sums up the problem. It's an old plant, old infrastructure, but you got to have quality water at the source. So just a few more pretty pictures and we'll get going here. The National Guard came in to help us. It was kind of our mini Katrina there for a couple of days. Carol Stepien from the University of Toledo. Shoreline. That's one of my favorites. That kind of shows you how thick and dense it can get. Couple of signs. For Gabriel from R.C. Grant. And that story I had, just kind of underscoring it was a once unthinkable crisis in the world's greatest freshwater region. And you got to always end a presentation with a nice, pretty picture of a sewage outlet there, sewage overflow. So that's it. Let's have Jeff Reuter take over from here. Jeff's for years with Ohio Sea Grant and OSU Stone Laboratory. Now serves as a special advisor, and he's had more than 40 years on the experience on the lake there.
All right. What Tom had asked me to try to do was to go through, give you a real quick update on why we're having these harmful algal blooms and maybe some of the solutions that we believe will solve the problem. And related, I'm going to try to relate this to Lake Erie, to Great Lakes, but also bring it back to the issues. I've been looking at the various meetings that have been going on at this conference, and the issues that are being covered have been incredibly impressive. I'm going to try to pull those in and also provide just a little bit of background that should be usable by the other speakers. So Lake Erie has often been called the poster child for pollution problems in this country from when the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland burned in 1969. And when the river burned, it was actually the fifth time that it had burned. We very seldom see signs like that on rivers.
The very next year, we had US EPA formed, NOAA formed, and we had the first Earth Day. And that's really why Lake Erie sort of called the poster child for this problem. We've had these problems. This is, that infamous hand. This is the hand from 1971 at our laboratory up at Put-in Bay in a harmful algal bloom. So the problems we have now, we've had before. These have been around for a long time. This is the laboratory up on Gibraltar Island at Put-in Bay. And you can see some of the things that we're going to be talking a little bit about climate change and the impact that climate change is having on these, and some of the things that we can all be doing to address climate change with solar thermal, solar panels, low-flow toilets, low-flow shower heads. We went from that image in 1971 and became the walleye capital of the world on Lake Erie, and we did that by reducing phosphorus loading by about 60%. from 29,000 tons down to 11. But in those days, the primary source of the phosphorus had been poor sewage treatment. Today, it's a different challenge. The primary source is a non-point source runoff from agriculture. This is the image that Tom had showed you. So again, we went from 1971 to a relatively clear lake, walleye capital of the world. This is 2010. This is the giant bloom from 2011. And in this bloom, this was in October, we now covered the water intakes for 2.8 million people with a harmful algal bloom. You can see it on both sides of the lake, also on the Canadian side of Lake Erie. This is my hand in 2013. So the stuff is back. It's not getting better at this point. So let's talk about the preferences. What do the cyanobacteria or blue-green algae like? And this will help you to understand why you might be seeing them in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, and where you would predict they would occur. So that, and again, these are preferences. You'll find them outside these ranges, but they essentially like warm water, above 60 degrees Fahrenheit. They need high concentrations of nutrients, particularly phosphorus. In freshwater, phosphorus is usually the limiting nutrient. We also know that some of the blue-green, some of the cyanobacteria, are capable of making their own nitrogen, fixing their nitrogen from the air if it's low. And the source of these nutrients doesn't matter. It can be poor sewage treatment, it can be lawn care, it can be agricultural runoff. It makes no difference at all. So these preferences sort of tell us where we might expect cyanos to occur around the world, and these are, we call them harmful algal blooms because they're capable of producing toxins. When you have the right conditions, over on the right, warm water, high concentrations of nutrients, you get the blue-greens or the cyanobacteria. When it's really cold, you tend to get diatoms. So the algae's out there all the time, hundreds and hundreds of different species. When you have warm water and low concentrations of the nutrients, you get green algae. The diatoms and the greens are really good for the food web, good for the food chain. The other critters within the food web use those. The blue-greens are not used for much. They're sort of a waste. Normally, the limiting nutrient is phosphorus. We know that reducing both phosphorus and nitrogen is going to help the most. So why Lake Erie? Why do we see these things in Lake Erie? Well, it's the southernmost of the Great Lakes, and if you look at the lakes in cross-section, it's also by far the shallowest. 210 feet deep max, Lake Superior, 1,333 feet deep. So if it's the southernmost and the shallowest, it's going to be the warmest. And remember, the blue-greens like warm water. Okay, now also look at the watershed and think of the other issues that you're probably talking about during this meeting or you've covered in your reports, and they'll say what we're going to say, the loss of wetlands or the loss of forest. Well, you look at the watershed around Lake Erie. The watershed around Lake Erie has the most ag, the most urban, the least forest, the least wetland. And that starts to tell you again, what is causing these problems? Why do we see them on Lake Erie and not the other places? And if we look at now just Lake Erie in cross-section, you can see the western basin of the lake, west of Sandusky, really small. That's about where 95% of all the water that comes into Lake Erie comes into that western basin. And that's about where all the nutrients happen. And if you look at the central basin of Lake Erie between Sandusky and Erie, Pennsylvania, you see that it's sort of moderate in depth. The red line's the thermocline, so below the red line is the cold bottom layer. That becomes anoxic during the summer. So we have our own dead zone on Lake Erie that covers about 3,000 to 4,000 square miles. Lake is about 10,000 square miles in total. Most of the water comes from the upper lakes, but that small western basin gets drainage from about 7 million acres of agricultural land. And the largest tributary to the Great Lakes is the Maumee River that flows right in at Toledo, draining 4.2 million acres of ag land. Those are the images that Tom showed you. That's one of the reasons that we see the harmful algal blooms there. All that warm water, shallow water, nutrient-enriched water makes Lake Erie the most productive of the Great Lakes. And if you compare the extremes of the five Great Lakes, Lake Superior at one end, Lake Erie at the other, deepest, shallowest, coldest, warmest, biggest, smallest. Lake Superior's got about 50% of the water in all the Great Lakes and 2% of the fish. Lake Erie, because it's nutrient-enriched, shallow, warm, has about 2% of the water, but 50% of the fish. It's difference in the system. It's incredibly different. All right, the phosphorus is coming primarily, or we know that phosphorus from sewage treatment plants, the quantity varies little from year to year. But the phosphorus coming from ag runoff varies tremendously depending on how much rain we've had. We have a wet year, we get a lot of phosphorus. We know that the majority of the load comes in during storm events, and we know that because of climate change, you'll see the increased frequency of storms that produce more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, up somewhere between 37% and 53%. You look around the Great Lakes now, the pink bars there represent the amount of phosphorus coming in from all of these different tributaries. The Maumee River down at Toledo puts in about four times as much as the next largest tributary, about 4,000 tons per year coming in out of the Maumee. And looking at these loads, we can then go around the lakes and we can say, okay, well, we're going to see a bloom at Saginaw Bay where the Saginaw River comes in, and we do. We can see a bloom at Sandusky Bay. We can see a bloom up at Green Bay where the Fox River comes in, and these are all your largest loads of phosphorus coming in. And it creates other problems besides harmful algal blooms. Western Basin, we get harmful algal blooms. Central Basin, we get a dead zone. Eastern Basin, we get excessive amounts of cladophora. And some of the new things we've learned, we think of phosphorus as just phosphorus, but we should really be thinking of two different kinds of phosphorus. Particulate phosphorus attached to sediment particles, insoluble phosphorus. Particulate phosphorus is about 25% bioavailable. Soluble phosphorus is 100% bioavailable. So when we think of solving the problems, removing 1 ton of soluble phosphorus has about the same impact of removing 4 tons of the particulate phosphorus. And most of the most of our work on BMPs has been focused on removing the particles. Yes, ma'am. Cyanobacteria and blue-green algae are one and the same thing. The question was essentially, are the cyanobacteria and the harmful algal blooms different? And the blue-green algae, another name for blue-green algae is cyanobacteria. Cyanobacteria is actually a more accurate name for them. And they are the harmful algal bloom. I grew up learning these things are blue-green algae. But as our microscopes got better and we were able to look at the ultrastructure of the algae, we could see that on blue-greens, there's no membrane around the nucleus, which means they're really more like a bacteria than an algae. And that's where but they're a chlorophyll-containing bacteria or a cyanobacteria. That's where that name came from.
Let's save questions for the end.
Okay.
We really have to get through. We have a lot of
questions. All right.
That's okay.
All right. To solve it, we need about a 40% load in total and DRP for harmful algal blooms in the spring. For the dead zone, we need a 40% annual load. The different water bodies where you see these blooms around the country, they're all going to require different load reductions depending on that particular situation. Blooms from 2008 at the top, 2011 at the bottom, 2011 in the middle, and 2012 at the bottom. What does a 40% reduction look like? So what if we're successful, what would success look like? We take the 2008 bloom, we make it look like the bottom bloom. We take the 2011 bloom, we make it look like the 2008 bloom, and we take the 2012 bloom at the bottom and it goes away. And our goal, at least what we're suggesting, is that we have blooms that look like 2012 9 out of 10 years. And with that, I'll stop.
Great. Your next speaker, Kelly, do you want to stand or do you want to go behind it? Kelly Fries with the Ottawa County, he's Ottawa County Sanitary Engineer, but also is in charge of the water treatment plant in Port Clinton, Ohio, and will share some thoughts about the, from a water treatment plant operator's point of view of being part of the public's last line of defense against
toxins from algae from getting in the drinking water.
Okay, is Jeff, and thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the opportunity to come here. This is a great opportunity to at least express what our issues are. And I'm the reality of what you see and what you saw Dr. Reuter talk about earlier, and that is that we are in a situation where I am responsible for a water plant that actually treats the water and sends it out to the public to drink. So I have to take what the result of all this is, make something of it, and pass it on to everyone so that they can drink it without thinking twice, as we all did today, and I have a glass up here. I didn't think twice about where the water came from, how it was treated, and I just, as we all do, take it for granted that it's safe to drink. Ottawa County is a small county just east of Toledo. It's about 40 miles east of Toledo, and we serve a relatively smaller portion of people. We have 25,000 permanent customers, and we have, during the summertime, it's a highly seasonal area, so we can have 100, 150,000 people in our area drinking our water on any weekend during the summer. We built a new water plant back in 1999, 2000, went online, so it's fairly new. It's 15 years old, and in the water industry, that's relatively new. We use standard technology, standard ways of treating water, the ways that we're known generally in the engineering world as to how to treat water, and it works very well. Everything works fine. It's latest technology in terms of that type of treatment. So along comes, in the late 2000s, the issue with cyanobacteria, microcystin, and the problems it creates for treating water. So as people who are responsible for operations, engineers and operators, we look at this and say, okay, Mr. Science, what is the problem with cyanobacteria and what do we have to do to treat it? Well, we looked back into the history. We looked at what is happening. We knew that there were standards set by the World Health Organization of a maximum of one part per billion. And that was given, basically looked at as a limit not to exceed. And in the early 2010, 2011, we started testing for microcystin to see what kind of levels we had in our drinking water. We knew that we had microcystin in lake, but we really didn't know to what extent, if any, it affected our drinking water, because prior to that, we never tested for it. And at that point in time, and it still is, it's a guideline, it's a focus for treatment, but it's not regulated at this point, although it's being proposed. So we took it upon ourselves to start doing testing, and we found that we did have it in our raw water. So it's coming into our plant, but our plant's filtering it out. It's taking out through sedimentation, and at that point then it's being released into the drinking water, basically free of any microcystins or any toxins, so we feel comfortable that that's the case. And then along comes 2013, and we have a problem with a local township next door. There's a small township called Carroll Township that has their own water plant, and they had microcystin in their drinking water. So they decided that they should not, in consultation with EPA, they should issue a no drink order, and this was the year before Toledo happened. And they issued a no drinking order, and they came to us, being a neighboring water system, and received water from us. We actually had a direct connection with them, so we could provide them water right away. They looked at their system, realized that they had a ozone was part of their treatment process, and they could boost the activity of that and the productivity of that particular treatment and take care of the problem, and they did, and lo and behold, they haven't had a problem since. So the next year, 2014, along comes Toledo. Toledo, all of a sudden you wake up one morning in the 1st of August and now all of Toledo can't drink the water. There's 500,000 people that are sitting there saying, what, we can't drink the water. And so I'm on the phone calling our water plant, hey, we have any problems, what's going on here? They didn't know of any problems. We didn't seem to have any issues with our plant. So as Tom mentioned, Toledo had not done a lot to upgrade their system, plus one of the problems that we have with microcystin is it's new. It's only, in terms of water treatment, it's new. It's only been three or four years since we've really looked at it seriously, although microcystin is one of the oldest bacteria there are. It's just not something that was recognized as being a problem to drink. So I'm sitting there as an engineer saying, okay, make sure we're doing everything the way we can, but there are no books, there are no guidelines. There's nothing here to say that if you have this level of microsystem coming in your water plant, then you have to do this and this and this to take care of it. There are some guidelines, there's some recommendations, but nobody really has done any research. So one of the problems we have in our industry is there is nothing, there's very limited information to tell us what is the best way to treat for it in terms of how to maximize your existing water system. So we're sitting there with the conventional plant. It's new, but it basically has, we feed chemicals, we add sedimentation, we have filtration, we have chlorination, and then we send it out the door. And that's what almost all water plants do that haven't had upgrades. So, and that's what's called standard treatment. So I'm looking at our plant saying, okay, we add powdered activated carbon, which is a great absorbent. It absorbs a lot. It was usually used for odor, taste, and odor, but now we're using it to absorb microcystin. And we add permanganate, and we chlorinate, which is also a part of the process to take out and to clean your water, so as an antibacterial. But one of the issues that we have is that we don't know which one of those really takes care of the microcystin. It's still a problem in our industry. Our industry now is caught up in terms of understanding that there is a problem. We're now facing, as a water plant industry, different levels of treatment and reaction by different communities. And one of the problems that we have is that in our particular area, there are about a half dozen water plants, and they all are using different technologies to take care of the problem to different levels. Not only can you use the conventional way to treat it, but then you're also looking at situations with adding ozone as a treatment layer or adding microfilters as a treatment layer. And there really is some uncertainty with that. So if you go back to the situation and the one that's facing us, as a small community, is to what extent do we really need to do to treat our water? We have the research. Ohio State's done a great job of providing us support in terms of research. Obviously, we have journalists here who are doing a great job identifying the problem and getting out, letting you know what the issue is. And we're finding out from the journalists themselves that this is a much greater problem than just Northwest Ohio or Lake Erie. It's a problem throughout the country. And we're also, from the regulatory side, we're getting a lot of support from them, identifying ways that we can do to identify this particular problem. But what's really missing in this, and what we really have to do, and I hate to say this since I'm an engineer, but we need the engineering portion of this to step up and say, okay, we can tell you how to treat to the maximum ability microsystems with the current infrastructure that you have. We can always do better. We can always add different treatment devices to ensure that we're not going to have this problem. But one of the issues we have in the current water industry is maximizing what we have to identify and treat for microcystins, which is this toxic bacteria. There are other ones too, but this is the one that's particularly affecting us now, and it's one that's being regulated by EPA shortly. So what we need from us, and what I'm looking for now, that the gap it's missing, is the fact that we really are missing some engineering abilities here and some operational maximization that would help us determine exactly how to maximize the use of our water plant. So in lieu of that, and the problems that we face is over-treating, additional costs that are associated with that. So now we know it's algae season, which is about the 1st of August to about this time of year, middle of October. We add a lot of additional chemicals. We throw additional carbon in just to make sure, because we really don't have the background science to associate one-on-one. The other thing that we do and we're looking at is trying to weigh what we need to do in terms of maximizing our operations by adding additional treatment trains, such as ozone or microfilters or something of that nature, which would help us ensure the public that they are having safe drinking water. So from a standpoint, my standpoint as a small purveyor and trying to guard the public against any potential contaminations, also to try to make sure that we are providing the best product at the least cost, we're trying to weigh maximizing what we have versus adding additional treatment facilities and what really needs to be done to what level. And that's what we needed to improve what we have here. So that's my situation, and I wanted to pass that on to you. I appreciate everybody listening to our situation, because it is one that is affecting all communities in some shape and form. So
thanks.
Thanks, Kelly.
Our next speaker is Ohio EPA Director Craig Butler. One thing I wanted to mention, this, I had a story recently, and the same type of algae that's dominant in Western Lake Erie is becoming ubiquitous around the world, in Africa, China, anywhere from the Arctic to South America. It's 3.5 billion years old, but for the last 20 years, it's been on the rise throughout the world. Craig Butler doesn't regulate the world yet, but he has seen it on the rise here in Ohio, and he can tell us what you know some of the differences have been in Western Lake Erie and the Ohio River, and just the struggles trying to keep up with this monster in the first place.
Hi, good morning. Is it afternoon?
It's still morning.
Okay, good. Good morning. Good morning, Tom. Thank you. I have no desire to rule the world, for sure. So you've heard the saying, as Ohio goes, so goes the rest of the country. You've probably heard it maybe in a more political context, and maybe that's germane since we got a governor that's Governor Kasich, who's also running for president. But it is also true when you think about this issue. We've obviously been front and center on the environmental front related to harmful algae all the way back to, as Jeff talked about, just the kind of the dawning of the environmental age relative to the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. We always seem to be on the forefront. I think that we're on the forefront not only just in terms of the visibility of microcystin harmful algal blooms in Lake Erie, and as Tom had mentioned, we're seeing this proliferate in the Ohio River. We see it in many of our water systems across the state. But this is a national, international issue that we have. And I think, in part, many people across the country and across the world look to Ohio. We've been very aggressive and very progressive, in my view, about how we have been working to practically manage this issue from the level that Kelly struggles at every day, to a policy as well as a legislative response. And I will talk to you a little about that, just on how we're progressing in Ohio on all fronts. We're certainly not complete experts on this. There is a lot of science left to be developed, and a lot of, as Kelly talked about, practical application of that science on how we actually guide and advise water system operators on how to effectively manage running their treatment operations so we continue to be able to provide safe drinking water across the country and in the state. But we know enough, and we know enough to act. And as I often talk in presentations about this, it's a concept of adaptive management. Or when I talk to policy leaders, legislators, and others, I try to bring it right down to a basic level. I say we're trying to build an airplane as it goes down the runway, because we don't have, frankly, the luxury to either develop a complete response to the problem and then go implement it, or frankly, we can't build that airplane and then go fly it. We have to act now. We know that the problem exists. We know enough to be able to advance some technology and treatment ideas, as well as looking at some of the root causes of this that we know that will have a positive impact. And then we, as we go further and learn more, will adjust our policy and practical response and continue to move down that road. Tom, you had asked me in your opening remarks to talk a little just about Toledo and the Toledo Water Plant. So as you have seen the presentations, we have known and understood that we've had harmful algal blooms in Lake Erie for a number of years. It's gone on. It's been an issue in 20 years and many billions of years that we've had the issue. So why Toledo? And why last year? Toledo is a very unique system in terms of its water plant. And I'll just give you a few of examples of, in addition to it being a 70-year-old water plant, in addition to it frankly not having attention paid to it relative to asset management, as we call it, over the years, investing in new technologies and upgrading and design of the facility over the long term. Setting that aside, it's got some really unique characteristics that also make it very susceptible, and in my view, frankly, when the conditions were right relative to microcystin, contributed to the ultimate crisis that we had. First issue is They're a surface water system. They get their water from Lake Erie, but it's their only source of water. So Lake Erie is not just a predominant system. There are other systems that have Lake Erie as their primary source of water, but they may have a backup system, or they may have an interconnection, as Kelly talked about, with another neighboring system that can help them if they have a problem. But the city of Toledo has one source of water, and it's Lake Erie. They also have one water intake structure out in Lake Erie, and they have about 110 million gallons of water system per day. So they have one source of water. They have one source of treatment at their plant. They do not have any interconnections with any other community except where they're providing water to as a satellite system. So there's nothing there as a backstop that can help provide water from another source if they have a problem. Toledo also has no storage capacity other than their clear well, which is really big, like a 70 million gallon per day clear well, in their water treatment plant. You don't see, when you drive around Toledo like you do when you're here in Norman, you don't see water towers. And you don't see any upground storage. They have no reservoir storage, and they have no storage at all. So their system is an on-demand system. Bringing all of those factors together, you could see where one glitch in that system, no matter where it is, it could be electrical, it could be a supply problem, it could be any number of things along that critical path, and their system is interrupted. And when you interrupt that system, then you're having almost an immediate impact on the community. So when you go all the way back to the source and you think about, yes, we had an issue in Toledo because of harmful algae, cyanobacteria getting into their drinking water, causing that disruption. It could have come, frankly, from any number of things, basically because of the age of the system. It's a very old plant. And while they are moving very aggressively now to make significant upgrades to their plant, there are parts of that plant that are still at least 70 years old. In their low head intake structures, there are frankly electrical equipment there that is older than the original system, that parts cannot be sourced for those that need to be handmade. And as much as we've invested as the state of Ohio and the city of Toledo has invested very recently, and they've made dramatic improvements at the water treatment plant, there are still parts of that system that make us very, very nervous. And we've often talked with the city of Toledo about it, and Mayor Collins, even before we had the crisis. We were working with them to either bring them under a set of operational orders to drive changes or make huge investments. And they've been making real progress, but it's been an interesting kind of issue for us. Harmful algae relative to the state of Ohio is somewhat, go back into about 2009 time frame. We did along with US EPA, just a survey of all of our lakes at the time. We found a microcystin, harmful algae, in about 40% of those. That really started driving us as regulators looking at who takes water out of those systems. We've got roughly 130 water systems across the state that use surface water as either their predominant or only source of water. Drove us to start working on a strategy on how we were going to manage microcystin. And that was, Kelly had mentioned that, and was one of the folks that we had been working with in 2010, came out with, we knew we had the World Health Organization limit of one part per billion. We knew that data was very old and needed to be updated, but it was the best science of the day, frankly. So we used that, developed a strategy around how we would be doing testing at some of our facilities, testing raw water samples, what would happen if we had an incident like Toledo. And frankly, we had developed a strategy, we had worked on that strategy some, but we never had, until Carroll Township and more so Toledo, never had a need to actually implement it. So once the Friday night phone call came, literally the Friday night phone call came and said, we have microcystin above the World Health Organization number in our Toledo drinking water, we went to start exercising that strategy and found out that we had some faults in it. You know, how do we collect samples? How do we preserve samples? How do we make sure that we get those samples to the appropriate lab? How do we make sure we get the right testing done? So while we were in the middle of this crisis, we were frankly polishing that strategy and having to come up with kind of on-the-fly solutions to some really critical problems that ultimately helped us. But long story short, we've been dealing with this and been ever aggressive, more so aggressive, since 2009, 2010. and then into 2012 and then beyond. So I look at, let me switch gears and talk about just this overall issue is really a two-phase strategy for me, for Ohio EPA, for the state of Ohio. It's first, very simply, how do we keep people safe? And second, how do we attack the root cause of the problem? So when I look at the first question, how do we keep people safe? It's how do we work with drinking water systems to treat for harmful algal blooms, cyanobacteria, and improve infrastructure. That's our first strategy. In parallel, we say, how do we attack the root cause of this? And I'll say, if we address our nutrient issues in the watershed, as Jeff talked about, from whatever those sources are, Lake Erie will recover and recover quickly as it's done in the past. Now those are very complex problems, but you try to boil it down into two really simple one-line strategies, and that's really what we're focused on. So since 2011, our response overall, policy-wise, has been we've taken about $1.5 billion since 2011 and invested it in the watershed to improve drinking water and wastewater facilities, to do water quality monitoring in the watershed, to work with farmers to plant cover crops to help keep nutrients on the ground, recycle of dredge material from our 8 navigational channels that have dredging going on from the Army Corps, installing controlled drainage structures on fields, and working on fixing faulty septic systems. And you heard me touch on a number of issues there, including agriculture, because we work on really parallel tracks to looking at nutrient management. And we look at agriculture as one, whether it's predominantly for commercial fertilizer or manure management, is our predominant source of nutrients, phosphorus, into the watershed. But we also have wastewater treatment plants and combined sewer overflows that need attention. We've got failing home septic systems in our watershed, particularly in the western basin of Lake Erie, and dredge material from those navigation channels. So it's really a multi-pronged approach for us. And we had, before we had Toledo, been addressing this and passed a policy and some legislation called Senate Bill 150, which really required a couple of things, really voluntary, but we think are very effective. We're training 47,000 farmers and certified crop applicators in Ohio to train them to make sure that they're doing soil testing on their property, to make sure if they don't need to put nutrients on their property, they don't do it. And providing this training, we call it the 4 R's. It's the right place, at the right time, at the right source. There's always 4, but I forget one. Right source, right rate, right time, and right place. And it's really going back, and we've coupled this with the certified pesticide training that these farmers take. And we're about halfway through, I think, of getting all of them trained, working with the Ohio State University and the Extension Office through the Department of Agriculture to go through this training to start reminding them of some of these practices. By and large, we're also really stressing the soil test, because we're finding in certain places, if you go out in the Western Basin and do soil testing, there are individual farms and individual fields that have enough stored phosphorus on them that they wouldn't need to add phosphorus or nutrients to their field for 70 years. So there's a lot of material there. You're really trying to break somewhat of a stereotype here. Farmers will do what they did last year. They'll do what their fathers did. Is that one?
If that's possible.
Okay, yeah. They'll do what they have done year after year. So it's really breaking that cycle. So after Toledo, in terms of what we have done, it's really a financial and a policy response. We continue to make significant money available for upgrading our wastewater, drinking water facilities. Kelly and others have taken advantage of that. We're working, and you'll see a lot more response come in the coming year about combined sewer overflows and funding we'll make available, as well as for failing septic systems. Significant dollars we'll be able to make available. We also have a very committed governor to this, and lieutenant governor on the policy side. We recently, at the governor's request, worked with Michigan and Ontario to sign a collaborative agreement. Jeff had mentioned the 40% number. You get a 40% reduction in nutrients, we'll start seeing the response that we would like to see relative to harmful algal blooms. This cooperative agreement that we signed in a binational way recognizes that 40% is not just a policy goal, but something that we will achieve. And it blends in well with the work that Jeff is co-chairing, part of the Binational Water Quality Agreement, and it's something called Annex 4, which also seizes that 40% number and suggests that we're going to be getting allocations through this Annex 4 process to come up with what they call domestic action plans to help us develop strategies in our watersheds to make that goal and meet that goal of a 40% reduction. I think I'll leave you with this, and then be happy to talk about this as we go along during the questions. We're making huge, not only financial and policy investments, but we're really changing our entire strategy on how we look at this harmful algal blooms. We were really effective in providing a huge amount of response out to the wastewater drinking water plant operators to make sure that we made it through this year. And it was an all-hands-on-deck strategy. It's something that really is unsustainable for us, and I think for Kelly and his counterparts, it's really unsustainable. And we recognize that, so we have to continue to push to find the key to this nutrient reduction example so that we don't have to make the investments overall. I think we're very fortunate this year that we had the algae issues and not the toxicity that came along with it, but that doesn't mean that we can take our foot off the gas and just kind of whistle past the graveyard and say that we don't need something done. So with that, I will thank you, Tom, okay, for having me. And
well, speaking of Kelly and his counterparts, Greg Kale is the communications director for the American Water Works Association, which my hunch is a lot of reporters aren't as familiar as they could be with that organization and the science, what they do to represent water treatment plant operators nationally and through the research. And I was hoping Greg could, just for a few minutes, give us a perspective of what AWWA is and what it can do for journalists.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you inviting me here. I will say that, you know, in the presence of these guys, I'm not going to be able to bring this conversation along too much from a technical perspective because these are your experts. But I do want you to know, first of all, who knows who AWWA is before this? That's not too bad. Have I talked to any of you at any point? Oh, good, good. Is somebody waiting on a return call? AWWA has been around for a long, long time, and since 1881. It is the world's largest, oldest organization of water professionals. You may know of an AWWA chapter or section in your local neighborhood. So they have conferences just like this one that bring people together to share lessons from their local water experiences. So I would advise you, if you haven't looked into those, to do so. I'm just going to say a few words first about AWWA, and then I'm just going to back up to a broader kind of national perspective. I know you've heard a lot about what's going on in Ohio, and in a lot of ways, I think we're all learning from the Ohio experience. How many of you are from Ohio in this room? Are most of you from other places? Okay. All right, so for those of you who are not, I think maybe I can, a way to be additive would be to back up and talk a little bit about what's going on the national level. So AWWA itself is made up of largely water sector professionals, people who work at the utilities, anybody from the resource planning to the GMs, to the people in the distribution part of the operations, increasingly people who work in wastewater treatment as well. So this is not a new issue to our kinds of people. As a matter of fact, you know, as I was preparing for this, you know, I went in the cube next door and we actually have a poster on algal toxins. You know, I'm not sure what marketing guru decided that we needed to sell posters on algae, but if you want one of those for your living room, I imagine that they're probably still in stock. But right up there in the upper left-hand corner of the poster is Microcystin. And so as much as this is a new issue, and because of what happened in Toledo has certainly turned up the temperature, it's something that water professionals and through our organization and our technical journals, we've been discussing this for a long time. So I put on the back sort of a who we are and contact sheet. So please pick that up. And we've got experts from throughout the country If we can't handle questions on staff, we can certainly help you. We also have people in Washington, D.C. We have a government affairs office. I'm headquartered in Denver. We have about 150 staff there. But in D.C., we have people who work on legislative and regulatory issues and bring experts from around the country to talk to Congress and talk to EPA as public policy and regulations are developed. So we can certainly be a good air traffic controller for you as you're looking for those kind of stories. Turning to the issue at hand, I will tell you AWWA has testified twice that I know of before subcommittees related to this issue of cyanotoxins. And we, as you may have imagined from what you've heard before, are also primarily view this as a source water protection issue first. We are interested in perhaps exploring the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act in the future to see whether or not we can better manage non-point source pollution so that we can reduce those amounts of phosphorus and nitrogen in source waters. I would also, you know, maybe a point that hasn't come up that would be of interest certainly from us in the drinking water perspective. You may know that EPA issued health advisories for two cyanotoxins in June. A health advisory is not a maximum contaminant level. It's not a regulation, but it's often a starting point for something. It sets a level at which they know that that there are no expected human health impacts. So those starting points there's somewhat of a challenge for the water utilities out there because, first of all, these are recommendations, in some cases there's a question of when's the appropriate moment to issue a do not drink advisory. We all know that those are, Tom could certainly tell you that that's a major, all the people in Toledo could tell you that it's a major issue to issue a do not drink, do not boil advisory for a community. Certainly from the public health and the safety aspects and of course the economic impacts of those. So the recommendations are, when EPA issued the health advisory, it also issued recommendations about when you should issue those advisories, which was a little unusual to coincide with the advisory. We at AWWA thought that there might be a whole lot of those advisories being issued throughout the summer. That didn't happen. So we're waiting to see as EPA and as utilities look at the summer season what the reason for that was and whether or not we should expect more in the future. Going back to Washington, it was just recently that there was a new law passed, the Drinking Water Protection Act, that's going to require EPA to develop a strategic plan on algal toxins. They had a 90-day window to do that from when the time that that law was passed, and we expect that we'll see that in November. So I would keep your eyes open for that. You're likely to see some updates to the recommendations that went along with those health advisories. I think you will also likely see that certain cyanotoxins, principally the two that were identified in the health advisories, microcystin and cylindrospermopsin. Did I get that right, guys? Yeah. It's a great word, but I can't say it very often. So I suspect that you will see that those will be, that utilities will be asked to include those when they do their monitoring under the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule in the next round of that. So that will help EPA get a better vision of the occurrence of these on a national level, and that might also promote a national regulation on at least those two. So those are some of the significant things going on in Washington. Other than that, I think I'll save the rest of my time for the questions for these people and myself, but I do want to stress to you that we have a lot of resources available to you. We just recently published a water utility manager's guide to cyanotoxins. You can get this off our website. There's Q&As in there. And you know, while I talked specifically about source water protection is maybe what we see as the most efficient way to control these, to control this issue, it also talks about what the management strategy from the drinking water utility can be in order to make sure that, yes, while we work on those long-term strategies, we're also keeping the water safe today. So with that, I will go ahead and turn it back to you, Tom.
Sure.
Frank Selassie, our last speaker, has a unique perspective of being a former Toledo City Councilman, being very passionate about his city, and also being passionate as an environmentalist with the National Wildlife Federation. So, Frank, maybe you can kind of just wrap things up for us and tell us what this means from the human side of.
I apologize. I've been checking my phone. We're all here in Oklahoma, away from loved ones and family. I'm missing my children's last cross country meet at Maumee Bay State Park, and I bring it up because there aren't many public beaches in for you know a waterfront community. There aren't very many public beaches, and Maumee Bay State Park has the biggest and best beach in the area. But it's frequently closed because of E. coli and nutrient pollution. And so I'm glad my kids are running there. I wish I could take them back to the beach more often at Maumee Bay State Park. You know, Tom asked me to talk about sort of the human element. First of all, because, you know, I had been with National Wildlife Federation working on this, when we got words that Saturday morning, it wasn't very surprising to me, but it set my neighbors off in somewhat of a panic. It set family members off into a panic. They drove hundreds of miles to try to get bottled water. Parents couldn't were advised not to bathe their children. Restaurants closed. Scheduled medical procedures in hospitals. Scrambled. There was particular concern among hospices in managed care facilities for procedures that folks there needed, regular water, transfusions, and things like that. And so it really turned the community upside down for 48 to 72 hours. The local elected officials responded, I think, as well as they could. Certainly Governor Kasich and Director Butler were there along with you know, all the elected federal and state officials and local officials. And the newspaper really provided a lot of valuable public service during the crisis and since then. Being, as much as anybody can, an honest broker between the science and the causes of the problem. We heard from Jeff about you know, the volumes of dissolved phosphorus that flow down the Maumee into the Western Basin. You know, the ratepayers for the city of Toledo, although they didn't make the investment in the treatment plant, did see their water rates over the course of the past 10 years double to control combined sewer overflows. And that is at a time when a lot of middle-class families in Toledo were grappling with the Great Recession. As an elected official, I can tell you I heard it when their water rates doubled. And so you know, the ratepayers are trying to do their part to clean the water. And, in fact, the ratepayers are paying for the externalities of the pollution upstream that is flowing past them, literally right towards the Toledo water intake. And so through National Wildlife Federation and other NGOs. You know, we've been advocating a mix of short-term and long-term policy solutions that we think will make a difference in really solving the problem of excessive nutrient pollution in the lake. And if we can be successful in the western basin of Lake Erie, certainly the stakes are huge for other parts of not just the country but the world. And so I don't think we should underestimate, you know, the stakes that folks like Director Butler, you know, are shouldering and in leading on. And as an NGO, you know, we're trying to work with, and we are working well with the Ohio EPA. We have a partnership with them. We have a formal partnership with the Board of Lucas County Commissioners, providing an advocacy and policy expertise service to them. Lucas County, of course, the county seat is Toledo. But, you know, we have I brought with me literally 4 pages of policy recommendations, some of which have been adopted. We, you know, asked Governor Kasich to exert leadership. He responded. He was exerting leadership before we asked, but, you know, we were gratified that he and Director Butler rallied Michigan, Ontario, and at some point Indiana will get on board to get the 40% to formalize an accord to reduce phosphorus pollution by 40%. We're having a policy conversation now about the best means to identify sources, identify amounts in you know, the proper set of metrics to reduce phosphorus. In the Western Basin, we favor a basin-wide watershed scale TMDL under the U.S. Clean Water Act. It's limited in that non-point sources are not, you know, don't face the same amount of regulation that point sources do, and we believe that's complementary to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement Annex 4 process. Deeply concerned as an organization about the fate of the game fish in the Western Basin. Walleye and yellow perch haven't always been the go-to species in the Western Basin. And with the dead zones that are happening, the changes that climate change are bringing, the threat of the threat that invasive species pose, we could lose the walleye. We could lose the yellow perch. And we've lost important species before. In 1916, 48 million pounds of cisco was hauled in from the Western Basin. We've lost lake herring and blue pike and whitefish. The whitefish you get from Lake Superior is great eating. But, you know, we've lost. It occurred to me last night watching this racing extinction movie that habitat loss and human impact has taken a heavy toll on the Western Basin, and you know, through the efforts of the folks on this panel and their colleagues in my organization and other organizations, we're turning the corner. But we need to look forward. We need to understand the impact that climate is having on the land in the water. It's increasing the hydrologic cycle. At one of the hearings at Maumee Bay State Park, after the event, the farmers didn't know what to do about 3-, 4-, 5-inch rainstorms. And so just prior to this panel, I was at the Climate Adaptation for Agriculture panel and got a great idea. Here in Oklahoma, there is a functioning carbon market for soil. What they're doing is planting cover crops, basically, and it's providing various ecosystem benefits, including soil health, but it's also sequestering carbon. And so it's found money for farmers in Oklahoma. I think that would be a great idea for Ohio. So I have a lot more to say, but we're running out of time, and I'll be happy to join these guys
let's
answering
take some
questions.
I know you guys have been waiting. We don't have a lot of time, but we want to get some questions in. Who's got? Go ahead, Kathy.
Thanks. Kathy Kowalski, based in Ohio. To what extent do, I mean, after you have a harmful algal bloom, the algae die and they sink, and that contributes to the dead zone. But to what extent does that interact, say, with perhaps churning up some of the toxics from the bottom of the lake that have settled there from heavy metals? I know we had power plant pollution and so forth. And also, to what extent do factories or power plants or other things with cooling water outlets contribute to some of the extra, do they make areas worse in the algal blooms?
Thermal discharges from power plants tend to make or create conditions that are conducive to harmful algal blooms because they like warm water. When we get a dead zone and the excessive quantities of the blue-green algae sinking to the bottom make it more likely for us to have a dead zone, and a dead zone is an area with no oxygen. So when it goes from an oxidizing environment with oxygen present to a reducing environment with no oxygen, the heavy metals that are buried within the sediment re-dissolve into the water. So when we get a dead zone, you're going to have high concentrations of a number of heavy metals that create problems for water treatment plants.
Next question.
I'm Megan Fitch from University of North Texas, and I had a couple questions. The first one being, as far as the algae is concerned, have there been any efforts to utilize probiotics, bacteriophage, or other forms of nanotechnology in order to address this, to kind of shift the microbial profile from a pathogenic one to a healthy one? And in general, as far as waste water treatment, have there been any efforts to deal with hydrophilic compounds, specifically estrogenic compounds, in the drinking water?
I'll let Kelly talk about the estrogenic compounds, but as far as the, we have two projects underway, at least two that I'm aware of, that are focused on one being what bacteria can we find native in the lake right now that actually can utilize microcystin, that are growing on microcystin. We found several of those. And from the standpoint of, say, a virus, and can we identify viruses that could attack microcystis, that work's going on right now at Ohio State University and at Kent State University, and maybe other universities also.
As far as the compound that you mentioned, from a standard wastewater treatment process, I would say the answer would probably be no. I think from a research, possibly yes. But I deal on a day-to-day basis with what is standard in the industry. And something like that might be of value, but it's not being looked at specifically on the day-to-day operational scale. Craig might know more about the research portion, but I'm not aware of anything. We're not monitoring it, no.
I'll just mention one thing, so just kind of put it in perspective around harmful algal blooms and microcystin. There are so many different, help me, Jeff, with the right terminology, varieties, species of congeners of microcystin, and you know, there, I think there may be maybe over 100 different congeners that we know of. 80 and 100 congeners of microcystis that we are aware of.
There was only like 15 back when the World Health Organization guideline in 1998.
And the point there is when we're talking about looking at it relative to testing and for applying either the World Health Organization number or the new health advisory number from US EPA, we're looking at two of those species. And there is so much science yet that we don't know about all the rest of those congeners, and or whether or not they're capable of producing a toxic response when they die. So whether it's estrogen and some of the other newer emerging contaminants, or whether it's microcystis and the different congeners, there is a whole lot of uncertainty. And, you know, you can speak to that, too, from your...
Yeah, well, I don't know how well I can speak to that from my perspective, but I can tell you that two organizations, if you're looking for research that might help, there's both from the drinking water side, the Water Research Foundation, actually an organization that grew out of AWWA many years ago, and then there's the Water Environment Research Foundation that does a lot of the same kinds of research on the wastewater side of things. So I would at least, if you're looking for that kind of research, go to their websites and examine and see what you can find.
Also, just real quick, I did a Sunday story on the science that went into the World Health Organization standard, and we haven't mentioned that this toxin, microcystin, killed 75 people in Brazil in 1995, and an unusual case where it infiltrated a kidney dialysis center. But that just goes to show that, and it was a major investigation by the Centers for Disease Control, it goes to show that it is serious stuff. But when the World Health Organization recommendation was made in 98, there were about 15, if I'm going from memory, and now there are 80 known cogeners. And like Craig said, all the research is primarily focused on just one, the most prevalent one, which is microcystin LR. Most of them attack the liver. One that I know of and have been told about attacks the brain, is associated with Alzheimer's. So you can't necessarily assume they all act the same, but we literally don't have much research on 78, 79 of these. And I know in the Toledo water crisis, there was four of the 80 cogeners that they've found that they know of. So, other questions? Cynthia?
Hi, I'm Cynthia Barnett. I'm an environmental journalist based in Florida, and I cover water, and I think I've interviewed some of you. Thank you for the excellent panel. I just had a quick question for Greg and then a broader question. Greg, you said you guys were expecting many members to have to put out advisories over the summer after the EPA set its guidelines for advisories, and you didn't get those many. Did you get any? Were there any advisories this summer?
I have not seen any boil water advisories for utilities. That does not mean that there were not some, okay. And I suspect that there may have been some. But I could look into that more for you. I would say that there have been, just if you scan the internet, you'll see plenty of stories about cyanotoxins and dogs who have perished swimming in waters, beaches that have been closed, and those kind of things. So there certainly have been a lot of impacts from the algal blooms. I am not aware of any of the advisories specifically. Okay. Do not drink, do not boil.
Okay. And so then this is a more general question, maybe for the communicators like Tom and Greg. This topic is so complicated to explain to the general public, and there are a lot of terms that seem to be used interchangeably: blue-green algae, harmful algal blooms, cyanotoxins, and then the toxic pieces, the microcystin, and
Cylindrospermopsin.
So if you could give us some advice, maybe Tom, or those of you who deal with the general public, what is the best way for us, what are the best terms for us to describe this to the general reader? What have you found that works best, and which of these terms should we avoid?
Well, most of the literature for the layman, it describes it as harmful algal blooms or HABs. And when you see, statements published from Ohio EPA and other regulators, they'll talk about HABs. Cyanobacteria is just, it's blue-green bacteria. The problem is this is bacteria. From a genetic standpoint, it's bacteria, but it mimics algae in the photosynthesis and the characteristics, and that's why That's why it looks like and quacks like, you know, algae, and so people refer to it as algae, but it's really, like Jeff said, it's really a bacteria. So, but harmful algal bloom is really, or also interchangeably with that blue-green algae. And when you really want to get, you know, geeky sometimes, you know, as we have in a couple of stories, you know, you try to, you may say like a, you know, a bacteria known as such and such or whatever, but... No, exactly. I mean, it's a real conundrum between precision and what it actually is. The problem is, you saw the pictures. People see algae and they think algae, but
I'm also a communicator on this issue, and I've had readers and on radio, so listeners say to me, "Wait a minute. This isn't really algae, is it? Why don't you please be more specific?" And so I have started, when I have to, I'll start with the use of the term algae, and then throughout the rest of the story, it's cyanobacteria.
People are actually, Cynthia, becoming more sophisticated, I've noticed. I actually had my managing editor, I mean, this is a good little anecdote. I mean, I worked with a graphic art department to do a big full-page Sunday magazine graphic on how a water treatment plant works, how the Toledo water, step-by-step, how the Toledo water treatment plant works. He comes to me and he says, "You know, you never put the word microcystin in here." I said, "Well, yeah, but I'm just trying to keep it simple." He goes, "Well, I'm sorry, but our readers are looking for the word microcystin by now." And I'm like... Yeah. And I was like, well, a year ago, I had to fight to get that word in the newspaper, you know.
So, I'll only say, I think Tom had it right, but you know this more than anybody here, it's, you know your audience. So if you're trying to do a piece that's just a very high level, top of the waves, you can use harmful algal blooms, and people will get that. If they have some more experience with it, as the folks in Toledo and Ohio do, you can drill down and get more specific. There's probably some tools that we ought to be able to give you, though, that can graphically illustrate these ideas, like Jeff had in his presentation, the idea of diatoms and blue-green algae and green algae, and then progressively, as you drill down into that, what the different vernacular is that would be helpful for your purposes or otherwise.
Yeah, Justin Chafin at Ohio Sea Grant, who works with Jeff, you know, he's an algae expert, and you know, he can explain. There are like, I don't know, 200 or 300 different types of algae. Most of them are good. Most of them are, you know, supporting the food chain. It's just that these bad actors, harmful algal blooms, because they produce toxin, they're bad. So let's take I know we're going over a little bit, but questions from anyone else that'd like to weigh in?
You just said, there were 80 different forms, known forms of the cyanobacteria. They all at least have...
Just microcystin of the toxin.
Of the
toxin known as microcystin, there's 80 different varieties just of that. And then microcystin is one of many... itself too.
The microcystin is a byproduct of the cyanobacteria.
Yes, I understand. Okay, so are there different forms of the cyanobacteria that you guys have seen, or is it just the one?
Go ahead.
Genetically, there are different forms of the cyanobacteria, microcystis. Some of them are not capable of producing the toxin.
Goes to the question that Kathy, you asked earlier. There is a real question right now. So, and we've all talked about this. In Lake Erie this year, we had a real heavy bloom of algae, harmful algal bloom. We had a real heavy bloom, but the toxicity numbers that Kelly and the other water plant operators had to deal with was very low. We've seen just the opposite. We've seen less predominant algae, but much higher levels of microcystin in the water. So Jeff and the team are asking those questions. There's a whole lot of thought going on about what's the limiting or driving factors there that have some predominance or not.
Well, when you think about, one of the statements I made was that the vast majority of the phosphorus comes in during storm events. So that means that it's really, for Lake Erie, it's coming primarily from non-point source runoff off ag land that we see real high concentrations. What's real interesting here, we know phosphorus is the driver in freshwater, but the things that Craig was alluding to, what we really believe right now is that nitrogen plays a real key role in the toxicity of the algae. And that's what we're trying to spend a lot of time and better understand.
Yeah, it's been said that phosphorus creates, just very simply in layman's terms, phosphorus is the main driver for the biomass, but nitrogen is the big, you know, more nitrogen you're going to have potentially more likely to have a more toxic bloom. Yeah. And this was, and what Craig was saying, this is NOAA's predicting that this is going to be the second largest bloom on record this year in Western Lake Erie, but yet it's been, you know, as a fisherman named Paul Pacholski up with a charter boat captains, he just came to me one day and blew a sigh of relief. He said, "We dodged a bullet, didn't we, with, you know, the toxin being so low," because it was much higher down in the Ohio River, which almost never gets algae, and they had a very high-producing bloom producing a lot of toxin down there. And you were asking about the words. One way that's easy to remember, microcystis versus microcystin. Microcystin ends with IN for toxin. Microcystis is the algae. Microcystin is the toxin. So, anyone else?
While you're asking that, Mom, you asked the question about have we had any advisories this year, do not drink advisories this year, and we had none in Ohio. We had several, so US EPA came out with a new health advisory number. It was now a split number over a 10-day period versus just a standard number of one part per billion. I can tell you that we would have had three or four do not drink advisories in Ohio at either a lesser level or for a general population if we would have been using the older health advisory numbers without having the split number for children and adults, and as well as being able to modulate that over a 10-day period, not just as a black and white drink or do not drink like we had in Toledo. We didn't have one for pets. We always just have a general precaution relative to, we're working on, and frankly with US EPA and the federal EPA, on what our revised health advisories will be for recreational contact. So we're still working off old data and science on that, but we expect that we'll have some peer-reviewed data coming out this winter and hopefully data that will allow us to revise the standards for contact advisories for swimming and beaches and pets and other contact.
In fact, this afternoon I was asked to by my publisher about dogs because they've kind of become known as the dog newspaper because of all the dogs they're suing. But US EPA said that they had done that and that
US EPA said they hadn't developed that, but that's a good question because a lot of the toxicity or the impact is based on body mass. I mean, an animal is going to be more likely to suffer effects or die from this before a human would in most cases.
Jeff DeBelko from Ohio University, and so is in Ohio, and I appreciate this conversation very much. Quite reasonably, we have a structure at SEJ where this is the water panel and there's a parallel land panel and a climate panel. So my question, particularly in the policy context, how much is this water topic connecting with some of those other areas? And in practical terms, so for example, with Jeff's presentation saying with the expected due to climate change, likely frequency and storm, increased frequency in storms, for federal or state level conversations around climate adaptation and what that means for our built infrastructure and these kinds of systems, Are those conversations coming together? Is there cross-learning among those different constituencies, or are we still going along our stovepipes or our water pipes?
I can tell you National Wildlife Federation is trying to get across sectors. We have a, you know, an ag department, we have a climate department, we have a water department. We're trying to integrate the conversation as best we can at the various levels of government that we lobby. Certainly, when you look at Ohio historically, it's lost more wetlands than every other state except New Jersey over the course of 200 years. The Great Black Swamp used to be half as big as the Everglades, and it's been totally drained, 15,000 miles of drainage. And so land use change has had a big impact, and it needs to be factored into the solution. There's greater concentrations of CO2, warmer water temperature, more frequent heavy rainstorm. Those are all climate impacts that have to be projected into the policymaking solutions. And so it is. It's as they say in graduate school, it's a wicked policy problem.
And I'll just pick it up from there and just simply say the idea that, I could only focus on drinking water from EPA perspective, but we've got a governor that just drives us and all of my cohorts to break down some of those silos. So you don't see me talking about this issue. It's kind of rare for me to be out here talking about it without having Jim Zeringer, the director of natural resources, and Dave Daniels, the director of agriculture, kind of sitting and flanking on both sides or something like that, where we aren't attacking this and developing a policy response. And many of the things I talked about today are cross-agency, complete, kind of an integrated government approach, much like Frank had talked about. So that's perhaps unique. I don't know, but it's at least a coordinated strategy.
Ben Sherman, Public Affairs for the National Ocean Service. Within the ocean surface, we're integrating under the theme of coastal resiliency, looking at water, looking at land, looking in space. And then there's also recently, just specific to this particular topic, NOAA, EPA, USGS have launched a multi-year project to improve the satellite diagnosis of freshwater, harmful algal bloom monitoring inland across all the lakes and freshwater systems. Yeah. And hopefully that'll start paying results off too. But there is, within NOAA, there is a concentrated look at tying together climate, land, and water issues under the theme of coastal resilience.
It's really, though, a very perceptive question on your part, because traditionally, I report to two vice presidents at Ohio State. I could go to meetings of limnologists or oceanographers, and that's all I had in those meetings. There wasn't a single ag person there. Or I could go to an agriculture meeting, and there wouldn't be a single limnologist in that room. I think one of the real breakthroughs on this occurred back about 2010 when Ohio formed what they called their Phosphorus Task Force, and they combined the efforts of the three agencies that Director Butler was talking about. And that group brought the different groups together. That became then a model for the Great Lakes, for the International Joint Commission between U.S. and Canada, and then most recently on our Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, where we're putting all those people into the same room. And I have found those to be the best meetings that I've ever participated in, because I learned so much. And I think everybody that participates feels the same way.
Any other questions? You know, we haven't even started to talk about animal manure yet, and it's lunchtime. anyways, could everyone please applaud our speakers today?